Please rise. Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bjorkman, Judge Bethan, Judge Frick, the Honorable Louise Beverly Bjorkman presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is Thursday, January 26, 2023. We have six matters on our calendar this morning, four set for oral argument. You will notice the courtroom looks a little different today, and that is because Judge Frisch is appearing remotely, but I think she is in a position where counsel, when you are arguing, you will be able to observe her, and I, you know, would expect that she will participate in questions just as she would if she were in the courtroom, so just be mindful of her presence in that way. The first matter on our calendar for argument is State of Minnesota versus Joshua Henry Van Cummings. Counsel, you are both familiar with our proceedings. You will each have 15 minutes to present your argument. Counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes. If you choose to use it, it's important that you state your name and identify the party that you represent. And you can see we still have the option of the podium close to you if you prefer more distance. The only downside of that one is it doesn't have the lighting, but if you are at the center podium, you can raise or lower it to match your need, and you will see a warning, a five-minute warning, and the red stoplight. So with that, Council for Appellant, you may proceed.
Good morning. My name is Leah Graff, and I represent the appellant, Joshua Bion, in this matter. Bion raises two claims for this court's consideration. The first seeks plea withdrawal under the fair and just standard, and the second seeks reversal and remand for further restitution proceedings. I'd like to spend the bulk of my time this morning on the restitution issue, but before doing so, I want to quickly address what I think is sort of the main sticking point on the plea withdrawal claim. Based on the arguments in the briefs and in light of the standard of review that applies to that claim, I think that the fundamental question for this court is, why was the district court's decision here an abuse of discretion? And the answer to that question is because the district court read Kim versus State as establishing a categorical rule that unilateral or one-sided misunderstandings about a collateral employment consequence is not a fair and just reason for plea withdrawal. And that is incorrect. Kim does not establish a categorical rule. Respondent continues to advocate for such a categorical rule on appeal, but it is incorrect that there is such a rule in this setting or that Kim versus State establishes one. So it's the district court's ruling based on an erroneous view of the law that is the abuse of discretion here. With that said, I would focus on the restitution issue, starting with the argument that the district court lacked authority to consider any equity or hypothetical home equity loan or line of credit when determining restitution in this case. So with respect to ability to pay, the legislature requires district courts to consider three things and only three things. That's income, resources, and obligations.
What is it about equity in a home that categorically would say that's not a resource available to repay restitution?
I think that the answer is sort of in your question, and that's it's not available. Equity maybe is an asset, but it's not a resource. It cannot be drawn on without some other action. The sale of the home for a profit, for example, that generates a source of wealth, the funds from the sale, that essentially extracts the equity, but by itself, just sort of day to day, it's not an available source on which a defendant can draw, as it would be required to be to fall under the definition of a resource. And the legislature did not include assets in the list of items that can be considered. I think generally the ability to pay term is used, but that sort of obfuscates the three things that are listed.
If I may, with that reasoning, would a home never be a resource? I mean, because you can't, it's not immediately available as an income stream under any circumstances, even right. If it's completely paid. So wouldn't your reasoning lead us to say, well, a house could never be a resource, so district court should consider that?
I think that is correct, Your Honor. And I think I want to answer what I think is sort of the underlying question there, that is like, why is that? How is that fair? And And how does that fit within our restitution framework? And the answer is that the way to get at assets is addressed in the restitution statute by the provision that allows the full amount of restitution to be entered as a civil judgment and collected on like any other civil judgment. There are rules established statutorily about what assets can be collected on through that process. If the defendant were to down the line sell the home and have that resource then available in terms of the cash that comes out of that sale, can be collected on through the civil judgment. Yes.
If we took that approach, then you could have people with, you know, I understand, I'm not saying this is the best of the case in any way with your client.
Sure.
You know, multi-million-dollar homes on Lake Minnetonka that are not resources, you know, that person individual-based restitution. I mean, I worry about the implications of this contraction.
I think that in that scenario, the court would still be able to look at income and resources that were available to that defendant. And my guess is in that scenario, there would be other income and resources different than Mr. Bayon's that would allow the court to consider and make a fair determination of restitution.
Resources had an immediate income stream or some sort.
I'm sorry, what was that?
But only if those resources had an immediate income stream. That's your position, right?
Right, if they are available to the defendant. And again, if there are multi-million dollar homes, they may not be all homestead property. They may be subject to collection under those civil judgment provisions that can be triggered. And that I think the statute demands be entered in the full amount of restitution.
Yes. Can I just piggyback on what Judge Jessen was asking? It feels to me that you're reading an additional word into the restitution statute, an immediate resource. Because, for example, if he sold his home at some future date, then that resource would become liquid and he would have the ability to satisfy the restitution amount. So I'm just wondering why, is that what's going on here, that it has to be an immediately available resource for the rest for it to be considered by the district court?
I think that that's correct, Your Honor. And I think every definition that both parties put forth in terms of the definition of resource involve availability or the ability to draw on the source or a source of wealth. And I think what you're talking about is if the home is sold and that can be used to pay restitution, regardless of whether the district court orders partial restitution in the criminal setting, that amount can, or that those funds, if the home is sold, can be accessed through the civil judgment process. And I think Alexander's rule about the criminal court lacks authority to order the sale of any particular property is sort of sends the message that why would we be considering something that can't be ordered to be sold, that can't be available in this setting. So it's just two different ways in which the restitution can be collected. And in the criminal setting, the legislature has only included income, resources, obligations, and not a broader asset term.
Does it make a difference here that the district court didn't order him to take out a home equity loan? I mean, I think this whole topic came up when the lawyers were discussing restitution and the court sort of mused, yes, I suppose one could do that. But ultimately, the court imposed a $50 a month restitution obligation as part of probation. So does it matter, this whole discussion about home equity? And
absolutely, it does matter, because the district court said one very important thing, that is based upon the possible, what I think is a possible home equity line of credit, I am going to order the full amount of restitution. And the court said, without that possible home equity line, you don't have the ability to pay. So if the court agrees with Mr. Bayon with respect to the legal error, that is, the court didn't have authority to consider that under the restitution statute, then it does absolutely matter, and this court would need to remand.
I'm trying to remember exactly how this came out. I thought the district court, as you just alluded to, gave him extra time to explore that, but then when didn't hear back, impose the minimal $50 a month. Doesn't that suggest that the court realized that wasn't an available resource and so didn't impose the full amount to be paid during the probation period?
I have two answers to that. One is I don't believe there was any lag time between the hearing and then the restitution order in terms of the full amount was ordered and the $50 monthly requirement was established. So I don't think there was any sort of delay in consideration there on the district court's part. And I think that the monthly requirement versus the district court's decision, explicit finding, if there is not an ability to get a home equity line of credit, you don't have the ability to pay, clearly impacted the district court's decision on whether to order the full amount of restitution. We know that it did because that's exactly what the district court said. So I just think that they are separate issues. And given the district court's explicit finding here about why it was ordering the full amount of restitution, it can't be sort of considered a harmless error.
So Ms. Grab, I know that you didn't weigh in, our rules permit you to weigh in on whether opinion should be presidential or not, but this seems to be a statutory interpretation issue, the one you're framing for us on the legal issue, which we haven't directly addressed before. Should we be considering a presidential opinion in this case? And maybe Mr. Clark later answer that question as well.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I think that this is an important line to be drawn, particularly with in this setting where the property at issue is marital property that has other legal restraints on his ability to get at any potential wealth sort of held within the property. And I think it would clarify that ability to pay only means the three items listed in the statute as the legislature has mandated. In terms of the hypothetical home equity loan as well, the other piece of the puzzle here that means it's not a resource is the fact that it didn't exist. Everybody acknowledged on the record at the time there was no home equity line of credit that he had applied for or obtained. And additionally, a home equity line of credit is akin to, you know, a credit card in some ways. The fact that you have a credit card doesn't necessarily mean that you have the ability to pay restitution. And so I think in any number of ways, the district court's analysis here goes well beyond the restitution statute's authority that it provides for the district court. Essentially, respondent is asking this court to permit district courts to speculate about the ways in which a defendant may down the line come into resources, the way a defendant may down the line be able to leverage current assets, again, not listed in the statute, to be able to satisfy restitution.
I mean, but counsel, isn't the home equity line just a measurement of the value of one of the resources that he owns? I mean, he owns the house. It is marital property, but he owns the house. That's his resource, or that's his asset. And whether he has an actual home equity line or not seems to not necessarily be material, other than it could demonstrate what the value of the resource is.
I think I disagree, because in that line of reasoning, we've gone far away from income resources or obligations. We started with an asset and then extrapolated possible means or approaches to leveraging that asset to obtain money to pay restitution. And so again, I'll sort of hammer home the point that is outside the scope of the criminal court's authority to consider under the restitution statute. There's a place for it in the enforcement of restitution as a civil judgment. And that's exactly why.
Can I ask just about why is that different from any other asset? Say, for example, hypothetically, a defendant has a pile of diamonds. I mean, they're very valuable. They could be sold for millions of dollars, they could certainly satisfy a restitution award. Are you saying that that hard asset that doesn't, that isn't immediately liquid, is something that a criminal court could not consider as a potential resource for purposes of satisfying a restitution judgment?
That's correct, Your Honor. The statute looks only at income, resources, and obligation. The
diamond and why isn't a hard asset that hasn't been liquefied a resource?
Because it's not an available, I guess, it's not an available resource to the defendant because it hasn't been, it's not anything that can pay the restitution in that form. But it could be, but it could be accessible through the civil judgment process. And I do think that homes and diamonds are different as well. There's a number of reasons that equity isn't the same as diamonds, particularly in a home that's a homestead property owned with a spouse. So I don't think the court has to go as so broadly as to preclude consideration of diamonds in any future case, but really focus on the home here. And that's consistent with Minnesota's long history of sort of unique treatment of homestead property, and a rule from this court on that would be in good company in that sense. I see that my time is almost up, and so I will wait to respond to any further questions on rebuttal unless the court has any right now.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning, James Clark, Assistant Attorney General on behalf of the state. So I guess I will do what the appellant did and briefly spend some time on the withdrawal issue and then probably focus my argument on this restitution issue. So, you know, it's correct that both orders on appeal here, right, we have a motion to withdraw a plea and a sentencing order. They're both reviewed for abuse of discretion. And there's no legal or factual error in this case. I think on the motion to withdraw, I think it's important to point out Mr. Byan does not cite a single case from this court, our Supreme Court, or any other court that holds that it was an abuse of discretion for a district court to deny a plea withdrawal due to a defendant's unilateral mistaken belief about employment consequences of a guilty plea. And I think it's incorrect. The district court didn't pronounce a categorical rule. The state is not seeking a categorical rule in this case. I think it's pretty clear, right, that in looking at a motion to withdraw a guilty plea, right, the court needs to engage in, you know, a unique fact-finding mission based on the facts before it. And that's exactly what the court did here, right? The court didn't pronounce a categorical rule. If you look at the court's here, written order that came out denying the plea withdrawal motion, they didn't pronounce a categorical rule. And never pronounced a categorical rule from the bench. And I just want to look at the specific facts here regarding the plea withdrawal, right? We have a unilateral mistaken belief that he would not lose his job at Regions. We have a defendant who didn't ask his lawyer about whether he would lose his job. We have a defendant that didn't ask a court about whether he would lose his job. We have a defendant that didn't ask his employer whether he would lose his job. At his plea hearing, he represented that he fully understood the terms of the plea agreement. There was some discussion, not about specific collateral consequences, but his lawyer asked him in relation to his Alford plea, you understand, forget the exact language, that there, you know, there's no difference between, you know, collateral consequences stemming from an Alford plea and a non-Alford plea. He said, yep, I understand that. I think it's important to note also whether or not this was fair and just, there was no evidence before the district court that granting him withdrawal, allowing him to go forward with trial, would get his job back at Regions. There was no evidence that that would actually happen if he was allowed to withdraw.
Although that's not the standard, is it? I mean, necessarily. I mean, you know, it strikes me these facts are unique because of the administrative hearing and proceedings that preceded the criminal action. I guess my question is, do you agree with appellant that there really was no prejudice to the state under these circumstances if the court had in fact granted the withdrawal?
I wouldn't agree that there was no prejudice. I would agree that prejudice was not substantial or overbearing. I mean, the prejudice here would have been delay, right? Delay for trial. Particularly important in this case, it would have been further delay on a case that was already very old, right? So what he pled guilty to was conduct theft that began in 2016 and ran up until 2019. Here we are in 2023. So it would have been.
But it's a case that would have been proved through documents, right? I mean, through records of when timesheets were submitted and when he was working at Regents. I mean, it wasn't going to require a lot of witnesses to recall facts.
I don't necessarily think I would go that far. I think he was making the argument that he actually did provide these services and that, you know, there was a recipient at issue here. These are personal care assistant services. So potentially, right, testimony from the recipient or testimony from people who knew the recipient about whether or not these services actually occurred back in 2016. I think that testimony has a potential to come out at a trial in this case. So I don't think the trial is just based on documents, although a large portion of the state's case would have been relying on documents to prove its case. So as a prejudice, though, I just want to point out, right, I think the case law is clear that, you know, prejudice is merely a consideration for district courts to look at, right? The state doesn't necessarily need to establish prejudice in order to justify a denial of a motion for a plea withdrawal. I also want to point out as to prejudice, you know, I prep witnesses for trial all the time, right? And there is a burden on witnesses that have to potentially be on standby for trial. They have to take time off from work to meet with prosecutors, to talk about, you know, testimony. So if they're, you know, they're entitled to some finality and certainty too. I mean, our witness is going to be on standby for trial potentially forever until, you know, a defendant comes in and, you know, says, well, I lost my job. I lost, you know, a scholarship. I was expelled from school. I lost my housing. You know, the list goes on in terms of collateral consequences that could stem from a guilty plea. I think it's important to note the burdens on witnesses, victims, and also on prosecutors in the courts. We need to have some certainty in the guilty plea process in order for really our system to function. So as to, did you have a question?
No, I was just going to move to the restitution. Okay. It sounds like you were about to do that.
Thank you. So the denial of a plea withdrawal was not an abuse of discretion, neither was the district court's restitution. I want to try to reframe this restitution issue, and I want to discuss a case that's not cited, I believe, in either party's briefs. It's a 2018 published decision from this court that I wasn't aware of until I did a moot argument for this session. And someone raised this case to me and I went and read it and I said, you know, that changes the way that I think about this restitution issue. So the case is State versus Davis and the site is 907 Northwestern 2nd 220, right? So in Davis, this court held that a present inability to pay cannot justify extinguishing a victim's right to restitution for its provable economic loss. I think that's exactly what is happening in this case, right? We have a victim that's proven its economic loss. We have a defendant that stipulated to the amount of the loss. And now we have a defendant that's claiming, well, I don't have a present ability to pay restitution. The court in Davis said under these circumstances, right, the appropriate thing to do is not to extinguish the restitution or say restitution is zero. The appropriate thing to do is for a court to order small monthly installments or extend the time of restitution, which I think is exactly what the court did in this case.
Mr. Clark, I'm familiar with the Davis case, but we have to look at that, at the issue of restitution a little differently after the Supreme Court's decision in State versus Wigan, where I'm not going to do the exact holding, but it leaves. The Supreme Court seems to be saying, "This was even harder look at this ability to pay." Isn't that a fair gloss on Wigan?
I think so. I mean, it's an important consideration that courts must do in deciding restitution. I think in Wigan, the Supreme Court said the court, you know, the record must show that the court took into consideration, right, a defendant's income, resources, and obligations. And I think what the district court did complies with Wigan. I think, I mean, we had a lengthy restitution hearing at sentencing where Mr. Bion was canvassed by the district court, by his counsel, by myself. I mean, there was a full factual record developed regarding his ability to pay.
And is there anything in that record, which you obviously know so much better than I do, beyond this, there's probably money in the house, you know, argument to show that there's an ability to pay, even the minimal $50 payment?
And I think there is, right? So putting aside, right, the issue of the house, right, the record shows Mr. Bion has a bachelor's degree, he's college educated, he's able-bodied, he has a significant work history. He was 47 years old at the time of sentencing, so he's got a ways to go before, you know, retirement age. And I think this idea about, you know, hypotheticals, right, a hypothetical home equity loan, right, I do a lot of restitution hearings, right, that's a large part of Medicaid fraud cases, right, arguing over the amount of money that's stolen. And a lot of times courts do engage in hypotheticals. The main hypotheticals that courts engage is, well, I think, because you're able-bodied, you have work history, I think you would be able to get a job in the future, right, to pay restitution.
But counsel, that's not what the district court found here. The district court specifically said, if there is not value in the home, then I would find that you don't have the ability to pay. So notwithstanding the fact that he is young and able-bodied and highly educated, and he could potentially have some earnings in the future, the district court made findings that he doesn't have the ability to pay, but for the equity in the home. So how do we reconcile those two things?
That's correct. The district court did say that, but I think the record does support the district court's finding that there is equity in the home. Right. So there were a lot of questions about the value of the home, right? He said, I owe $219,000 left on my home. I paid $1,500 a month for my mortgage. The PSI, pre-sentence investigation court, said he owned the home for several years. There was some discussion about it being a single family suburban home in Eagan with four bedrooms, two baths, two car garage. There was some testimony. He didn't know the exact value of his home, but he said my neighbor recently or sold their home for $290,000. So there wasn't a specific finding about how much equity was in the home, but I think the record does support the district court's inference or decision that there was equity in the home. And following up on that, I think the district court was appropriate to place the burden on Mr. Bion to say, well, based on what's in front of me, I think there's a fair amount of equity in the home. But if you can prove to me, right, that this isn't a resource that you're able to gather at this time, either, you know, there's no equity or you're not able to get a loan, come back to me, right? You haven't, you know, you can challenge my restitution order. Come back to me, prove that there's not equity in the home, and we can either revisit this restitution issue or I would find that you don't have an ability to pay.
And I don't disagree with your characterization of the record, counsel. I think that's eminently fair. I think what Ms. Graff is arguing is that the equity is not immediately liquid and therefore it cannot, and it's unavailable. So therefore it's not a resource that the court can consider within the meaning of the restitution statute. Do you want to address the interpretive argument that counsel is making?
Yes. So I think I don't have a case site, but I think a general legal principle is that courts cannot read words into statutes that are not there, right? So the restitution statute, when it discusses ability to pay, says a court must consider, right, a victim's economic losses and a defendant's income, resources, and obligations. It doesn't say a defendant's immediate income, present resources, present obligations, just as income, resources, and obligations. And going back to this employment argument, right, I think if you look at the case law restitution, right, you know, defendants are being sent to prison, right, without any wages, still being ordered to pay restitution, and court saying, well, you can either get wages, potentially get a job. So we're talking about hypothetical jobs in prison. We're talking about hypothetical jobs when people get out of prison, right? So I think the case law is pretty clear that the court can take into consideration future income, future wages. So I don't see why there would be any difference with, you know, future ability to, you know, draw on resources. And going into the case law on this too, I think, you know, the restitution pretty clear that courts have, the words are that are used are broad discretion, wide flexibility. You know, this isn't an exact science, right? There's very little guidance in those three words to what does it mean to consider someone's income, resources, and obligations. So district courts are kind of in a tough spot because there isn't a whole lot of guidance as to what they're supposed to do.
And that was going to be my question. Can you point us to any case that other than the employment sort of kind of speculation about someone's ability to obtain employment to satisfy restitution obligations, can you point to us to any other cases that suggest access to a home or other kind of resources that are not liquid, that can be considered?
You know, I can't right now. I haven't scoured the entire, you know, body of case law on this issue, but there's not in my brief, so I didn't find any, at least at the time I was briefing this. But I think, you know, going back to Judge Frisch's point about diamonds or stocks or bonds or, you know, rental property or second homes or Ferraris, you know, expensive cars, right? So if someone is going to lose their job because of a guilty plea, don't have much savings, but they have valuable assets. I think those are resources, right, that people do draw on, right? Stocks are things that people draw on. Home equity is something that people draw on. Judge Frisch's hypothetical about a pile of valuable diamonds, right? Those are all things that courts should be able to take into consideration. Those are resources of people.
There are a lot of cases that says that district courts can't order the defendant to sell property to satisfy a restitution order.
So
he can't order someone to sell the property. How is that different than, you know, at least implicitly ordering someone to set up a home?
And I wouldn't go that far. I don't think there was an implicit or explicit order in this case. I suggest, right, you go look into a home equity
buyer. I'm just concerned about that. There's probably money in the house to get one. And I'm trying to, that's why I was asking him what else is out there.
Yeah. But so bottom line, that was a suggestion. It wasn't in the written order. It wasn't, you know, at the hearing. It was merely a suggestion. I don't view that as any differently than saying, I suggest you get a job. I suggest you get a second job. I suggest you, you know, dispose of some of your savings, you know, to pay restitution. That's my time. Thank you. Unless there are any other questions.
Thank you, Colin. Okay. Scrap, we have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
I want to respond first to two primary points on the plea withdrawal claim. One is that counsel argued there is no categorical rule that the district court is applying, and this is addressed in the brief, so I won't belabor it, but beyond the categorical collateral employment consequence aspect of the district court's decision, there are no similarities between the facts here and the facts in Kim versus State. So you're left essentially with that categorical decision. In terms of prejudice, counsel referenced the fact that this was an old case, that the conduct occurred in 2016 to 2019, and that Mr. Bayan sought plea withdrawal in 2021. But the case itself wasn't old. The state didn't charge the case until 2020. And so when we're looking at what is the prejudice to the state as a result of the plea withdrawal, that delay on the front end has nothing to do with Mr. Bayan's motion for plea withdrawal, and it shouldn't be considered. And in terms of the nature of the evidence, the state's evidence would be documentary evidence. That's clear from respondents' brief. I think it's pages 5 through 6 or 6 through 7, listing the results of their investigation, all time records, airline records, timesheets from regions and from PCA work as well. Any potential testimony that Mr. Bayan may have elicited is that's his call to make in moving for plea withdrawal, whether that would be, you know, at risk down the line, but it doesn't impact the state informed prejudice.
Mr. Rapp, on the topic of restitution, yes. I'm having a hard time. You seem to want to read the word resource, talk about income, resource, and obligations being the things that district courts should consider when determining a defendant's ability to pay. You seem to be trying to equate income and resource in my mind. If you're saying that the resource has to be a liquid asset, why am I wrong about that?
Certainly. So income, I think, implies like a regular stream, a payment, you know, what we all report as our income from, you know, a job or some other sort of stream of.
Right. Or if I'm living off of interest on my.
Sure.
All of my stock holdings.
Correct.
So I have the old very, very limited income. Are you suggesting that restitution could not reach into the value of my stock simply because I'm not liquidating it all every month?
In the context of what the criminal court is to consider at the time of ordering restitution, yes, the court could consider the income stream from that stock, can consider an income stream from employment. If you had a significant savings account, that would be a resource. And then the restitution statute, again, allows for the stock to be accessed through other means. But in terms of what we're ordering a criminal defendant to pay, which has implications for liberty and compliance with obligations to the criminal court, that's a different set of items that can be considered. And that's what the legislature has mandated. In terms of the State versus Davis, I don't think that that case has any relevance here. This isn't a claim about extinguishing any victim's right to restitution. This is about the district court's statutory authority and whether the district court made a legal error in considering any potential home equity or home equity line of credit.
Is that a matter of authority or just error? I mean, are you really arguing the district court erred by considering this? I mean, district court has authority to determine restitution, right? Broad authority.
Well, it does have broad authority to determine restitution, but even just as recently as in Wiggum, the court noted that it's constrained by the restitution statute. So, and in State versus Riggs, the Court of Appeals held that the list of factors in subdivision one, that's it. It's an exclusive list. It says the following, and that's the scope of what the court can consider. I also just want to clarify one thing about the record. Mr. Bayan did not provide testimony about the sale of his neighbor's home. I think there was a question about recent sales in the neighborhood. It appeared to the district court that was based on Zillow or some similar website, and the court explicitly said, I'm not going to rely on that because I think with due respect to those websites, they're not a source that the district court was willing to rely on. So, you know, and I think that counsel's point that district courts, if I may continue.
You can finish.
Thank you. The district courts maybe do a lot of speculating is all the more reason for this court to establish a clear rule in this case, especially as it relates to homestead property. And for those reasons, we would ask the court to reverse and remand for a restitution hearing if it doesn't grant the withdrawal. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your helpful arguments. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period.